Hello and welcome everyone to today's online event hosted by the International Inequalities Institute and the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program. My name is Dr. Armina Ishkanian and I am the Executive Director of the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program. I'm incredibly pleased to be chairing today's event titled The Murderer, the Monarch and the Fakir, a new investigation of Mahatma Gandhi's assassination. Our speakers for today are the authors of the book, Apu Suresh and Priyanka Kottamraju, who were both part of the inaugural cohort of the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program in 2017 to 2018. Apu Estos Suresh is founder and CEO of PicStory, a new social media initiative launched in the United States in March 2021. Priyanka Kottamraju is a PhD candidate in sociology and a Gates Scholar at the University of Cambridge. She is an independent bilingual journalist from India with nearly a decade of experience in the media industry and focuses on issues of social justice, gender, and inequality. Welcome back, Apu and Priyanka, to the LSC. Albeit in a virtual manner. We hope one day soon that we'll be able to welcome you back in person. Before we begin the event, I have a few housekeeping points. First, please note that we have a live captioner and BSL interpreters at today's event. To activate the captions, please click the CC button at the bottom of your screens. You can also access larger captions by using the link that has been posted in the chat box. If you wish to make use of the BSL interpreting, please pin the two interpreters to your screen. To do this, hover over each of their videos and click the three dots in the upper right-hand corner and select pin. You are able to select more than one pin. Second, this event will run for around 1 hour and 30 minutes from 5 to 6:30 p.m. Initially, this will be a conversation between the authors of the book and myself. We have, however, allocated time after that discussion for questions from the audience. As this is in Zoom meeting rather than in webinar format, we are very happy that we can see our audience and we can have a more interactive event. May I please ask the audience to keep yourselves muted, but your videos on wherever possible. As always, there will be an opportunity for you to pose your questions to the speakers following the main event. Please do so by raising your hand and I will call on those who have raised their hand and you are able to ask your question directly to the speakers. I ask, however, that everyone please hold their questions to the portion of this event for the Q&A portion of this event, and I will do my best to take as many of your questions as possible. Before I turn to the event, I would just like to let the audience know that the next public event to be held at the International Inequalities Institute is titled Global Tax Justice in the 21st Century, Promises and Challenges. That event will take place at 6:30 p.m. on Thursday, the 1st of February. The link to this event, along with more upcoming events hosted by the Institute, can be found in the chat. Many thanks to all of you who've joined us this evening, and please enjoy the event. So now I'm very much looking forward to having this conversation with Apu and Priyanka. I was delighted to receive a copy of your book and have the opportunity to read it. And I want to begin by congratulating you both on this achievement. I think you're the first fellows who have published a book and the first fellows for sure who have published a book together, a co-authored book. So this is quite an achievement and we are very happy to host you here and have this opportunity to share and hear about your book. So the first question is one that you actually also address in the book. And this is the question of why is this topic relevant? Why does, and indeed, why should Gandhi's assassination matter to us today? So I ask you both, why does the assassination matter today? And why did you decide to write this book?
At the heart of this question is like, it was pursuit of truth. So, when you actually go through Gandhi's writing, you'll see that he was always in pursuit of truth, right? And truth is for him is like infinity. So, and everything that he did in his life is an experiment. So, and at the end of the day, we know Gandhi as a messiah of peace and nonviolence. So it's very important to kind of understand in today's context, why was probably the most nonviolent person in the contemporary history of the world was assassinated, right? So at the time that when I started investigating this book, it was around 2012. And around the time that when we were in LSE, the FSC program, a lot of things were happening around the world, right? To start with, you have very divisive leaders who was coming to power on a highly popular narrative that is that their nationalism is under threat, right? So if you actually look at it, the majority is under threat. So the paradox of defensive majority. And that is when we actually started putting this book together. But there were three elements of this book, which is the investigation part, what really happens, like a chronological recollection of events that happened from the start of the conspiracy till Gandhi's assassination, which is more like the investigative journalism part of it. Then we start extending that to what were the circumstances under which he was killed? What was the real motives like? And the third element is, why is it hold relevance for us today? So going back to the events that we're seeing from 2012 to now, when we completed the book, so it's 10 years, what you're actually seeing is unprecedented levels of lying, misinformation, and hate, which has been amplified through different channels, including social media. And also we're seeing a lot of politicians who we never thought will have a chance in public office, let alone being heading a country in many part of the world, were making to governments, right? So under this whole thing of different paradox of defensive majority. And this was exactly what was playing during Gandhi's assassination. And that is where the key to why is it relevant today, right? And I always imagine, what if Gandhi lived for another 10 years, right? So at the time that he actually went on this politics of nonviolence, there was no model ever before, right? So he experimented with a very unconventional politics to bring peace, right? So, and then it became a model which was replicated all throughout the world. And at that point of time, which I'm talking about the late 1940s, 1948, just before Gandhi was assassinated, he was taking his focus away from getting independence from India to give them economic independence. So, and that is a time that the world was divided into two economic blocks, broadly speaking, one led by the, or let's say three, one led by the communist bloc, one other by the socialist bloc, and the other by the capitalist bloc. What Gandhi was experimenting with was a different model, and that is his model of sustainable economics. I think we give a lot of credit to Gandhi as a political a political thought leader, a politician, a strategist, but I don't think that he has got his due for being an original economic thinker of probably, I would rate him very highly in the sense, because everything that he talked about at that point of time, like sustainable economics, development economics, or the trusteeship model that he kind of got inspired by Tolstoy and others. So he was experimenting with taking or decentralizing economic concentration of wealth. And I think one of the key motives of this assassination is also underlined by economic interest. So we always looked at Gandhi's assassination from the perspective of a political act or an act of a lone wolf for a small coterie of people who wanted to get rid of Gandhi because of misguided ideas. So Gandhi's assassination holds many keys to understanding A, what can hate do to probably the most nonviolent person in the history of the world? And the actors, how the whole process of othering happened? Or what role can misinformation and hate can play in an act like assassinating Gandhi? And also, what is the role of economic elite in a political assassination and how that can change? So I've taken a step back and looked at, what if Gandhi had lived for another 10 years or 15 years? We probably would have had a different economic model, because knowing him, he's always had the conviction to follow through his ideas and implement it. So for him, it's a slow process, because that is a real change. So Gandhi never looked at quick solutions. He said the only change and the permanent change is one reforming themselves. And it is through an act of persuasion. So, and that is, I think, is a key element of this book, to understand what happened then, how things would have been different, and why Gandhi was assassinated, and which Gandhi was assassinated. Did they kill a Gandhi who was mistook as an anti-national? Was it a Gandhi who killed was an anti-state? Or was it a Gandhi who was about to start an economic revolution? And just to give it to you in context for people who are not familiar with Indian politics, Gandhi's disciple, Vinoba Bhave, post Gandhi's assassination in the 1950s and early 60s, ran a movement called Bhudan, which is voluntarily giving up land by the landlord to the peasant. Can you imagine? They've aggregated land in the absence of Gandhi, mind you. Gandhi's disciple, who did not have the same standing in India, or his influence was limited to a certain pockets of India, could aggregate as much as 33,000 hectares of land, which is equal to the size of a state in India called Goa. Now, some of you are familiar with that state. So and that is what he achieved. And this is Gandhi's disciple. So imagine how Gandhi would have revolutionized an economic process or economic process of decentralization. So, yeah. So that is where the key to or the relevance of that book today.
I like that Appu has just plunged right into the book. I just want to say apologies for my light over here. It's I have a problem with the bulb. And I want to extend thank you to the International Inequalities Institute. It's like coming home again. It was our home away from home in 2017 and 2018. And it's great to be here and see so many familiar faces, former colleagues and friends. So I just very briefly want to add couple of points to what Appu has already said. I think the process of investigation, which went on for about 8 years, that as an investigative journalist, Appu was pursuing over the years, revealed details that have not been in part of the historical record yet. So what we have done is that there is information that is there in the evidence that we have seen through that takes the investigation forward. The last inquiry into Mahatma Gandhi's assassination was in the 1960s, undertaken by the Jeevanlal Kapoor Commission inquiry, which looked at the lapses in the assassination and also admitted two new pieces of evidence about the assassination, about the murder, which concluded, which helped them to conclude that there was a conspiracy, there was a guiding light for the conspiracy, and there was a cast of characters that thought about this particular act. And the evidence that we found reveals that that conspiracy, we've kind of seen the dateline. Usually what we've learned very little about it in our curriculums, in our school curriculums and textbooks. So we, as it is, know very little about Gandhi's assassination. But what we know, it comes from December to January, like a span of a month. So January 30th, 1948 is when he was assassinated. A failed attempt happened on January 20th, 1948. And the investigation, the probe also went from late December into January 30th, 1948. What we have done is provided evidence that sees that the conspiracy maybe began in early August 1947 itself. Maybe you could go backward and see that. So that's one point. There was new evidence that came to light, which shred some of the testimonies that were brought forth in the Red Fort trial, Gandhi murder trial that happened later on, as lies. So the other thing that I wanted to add, like what Apu said, was looking at our political present, we cannot help but think what has happened in the political past. And that sort of reminds us the various contestations that happened to over national character, over what kind of state we would be or what kind of national character we would have. Similar contestations are happening at the moment, and not just in South Asia, but across the world. And in 2017, we were in London at that time. And you know, that was the time of Brexit. That was the time of Make America Great Again. And various national myths were being constructed across the world. And we found that happening in India as well. And we thought it was very relevant to look back about this assassination, knowing the evidence that we knew, and to look at it about how the national character was under contestation again, and how the Gandhian character or Gandhian thought had faded from public memory. And for that, like, today, if you look at discourse in India, a lot of it is about the rehabilitation of various figures of right-wing nationalism. It is not at all about rehabilitating critically and empathetically about Gandhian thought. We've kind of lost him along the way. So that was a motivation for us to kind of put this in context.
Thank you both. This is very interesting, and I like how you have linked this investigation to the present. I want to pick up on a couple of points, but the first point I want to pick up on is, so Priyanka, you mentioned the August timeline, and in the book, you know, at times you call it the August conspiracy, and sometimes, you know, was this the smoking gun? Could you talk us through, because you were writing the book and investigating within this context of growing nationalism in India. So what were some of the challenges of accessing this? I know you're both, you know, have skills, but could you talk us through the process of collecting the data, the information you needed in order to write this book, to bring something new to this matter?
Thanks, Armine. I think on the first part of the question, we call it the August 8th conspiracy. That timeline, again, has not found mention in any of the inquiries or the trials till date. You know, to just get into some detail about it, it was the first time it was the time when Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, who is known as the father of Hindutva, and he is the founder of Hindu Mahasabha, which is a political organization, which was a political organization in India at the time. And all roads led to Hindu Mahasabha being the center for plotting this assassination. So Vinayak Damodar Savarkar and Nathuram Godse, who was the religious Hindu fanatic as described, who assassinated Gandhi, and Narayan Dattatreya Apte took a flight on August 8th, 1947 from Bombay to Delhi. And this was unusual for us to, I mean, as evidence, if you see, it seemed an unusual thing to do because Savarkar had already gone into retirement by that time. He was not active anywhere. And for him to come out of semi-retirement to attend a organizational conference or a meeting seemed like a cover almost for something. So the fact that the three of them traveled, and the fact that in Delhi, most of the final conspirators of the assassination met. And between August and December, all of the conspirators met. And this was something that was not brought forth as evidence. So even in the Kapoor Commission inquiry, there is a vague mention to a meeting in August, but it doesn't go into a detail about when it happened or what happened. So we were very interested in why this particular meeting had to happen and why a very low-key figure called Narayan Apte in the organizational hierarchy had to accompany the leader or, you know, the president of the organization. And that all the characters that finally became part of the charge sheet were had met and interacted. So that was the that's the first thing. And the second thing, I'm sure Apu would add a lot more to it because he's out and out investigative journalist. We relied on certain sources that are available publicly. There, those are the National Archives of India, the Nehru Memorial NMML Museum and Library, where a lot of the historical documentation as part of papers, Hindu Mahasabha papers, Balkrishna Munje papers, Mahatma Gandhi papers are archived. And a lot of books that have already been written by historical scholars, historians, we relied on those as well. And we relied on Manohar Malgaonkar's book, who had the opportunity to actually interview some of the conspirators. So this was the body of available work that we looked at. And then we went beyond that because this was also very haphazardly available. So for you to piece together the timeline of leading up to Gandhi's assassination is very difficult to do that. It's to go through the records and to come up with a firm timeline. Thousands and thousands of documents. And beyond that, I think Apu, you should kind of add to beyond that, what was publicly available, how did we get to the evidence?
So again, go back to the first question that you all, the first part of the question and the part that Priyanka answered. Why is it August conspiracy such an important one, right? So all throughout in the historical, the textbooks and all records kind of looked at, and including the statement by the accused, the assassin himself, is that the immediate provocation for assassinating Gandhi was the fact that he went on a satyagraha, which is a fast unto death, for releasing rupees 55 billion, and I'm trying to translate into like, because we use for 10 million, we use a crore. So it's like, we find a 50 million Indian rupees for, no, 55 billion Indian rupees, sorry, 55 billion Indian rupees for to Pakistan. And that was cited as the reason to assassinate Gandhi. So now that is happening somewhere in January, right? So the public perception is that, okay, Godse killed, Godse's assassin, who killed Gandhi because he was pro-Pakistan or pro-Muslim and by implication. But pushing the timeline before independence, that is, India got independence on 15th of August, 1947, and this meeting is taking place on 8th of August. Now, we have also brought in some elements to the record that before this meeting, because I'm talking about the 8th of August, one of the accused, that's Apte, who again eventually flown along with Savarkar, who's one of the key figures in the Indian right-wing movement, had met with an arms dealer and sought a gun and paid 1,200 Indian rupees at that point of time. So which means that the intention of assassinating Gandhi was there even before India's independence. So that completely rubbishes this theory that it was some immediate provocation. So that means it's a well thought out plan. Now that is, I mean, and this is coming after almost 74 years of Gandhi's assassination. So next year is 75th year. So it's almost, so revisiting this whole event and 8th of August becomes a critical element in the public understanding of probably one of the most controversial political assassinations in the history of modern world. So that's the August conspiracy relevance. Now, how did we arrive at it? So, you know, there was, while going through the files, you suddenly stumble upon this thing. Savarkar, the leading figure of the Indian right-wing movement, traveling with two people who have been convicted and sentenced to death for their respective roles in Gandhi's assassination, was flying together. So that obviously raised a red flag. And both of them were very low in the pecking order of the organizational setup of the Hindu Mahasabha, which is the lead character, lead organization in the assassination. So there is something off. And then we looked at what were they doing in Delhi at that point of time. So they were here to attend a meeting. And then you start looking at, it's just a tracing back. Who are the other people who attended that meeting? So that kind of gives you a whole cast of people who are there. So it kind of gives an indication that there was meeting of mind, if the very least. Right. So all the circumstantial evidences point to the fact that you know, there was an intent to assassinate Gandhi, because that get corroborated by the fact they were looking for a gun just 2 weeks prior to this particular visit. So it's a circumstantial evidence points to the fact there was an intent to assassinate Gandhi even before independence. So that improves the public understanding of the assassination and the and rewrite or kind of add to the in a contemporary history. Now, in terms of looking for the documents, so we relied mostly on three set of documents, which is the intelligence reports, which is managed by the Intelligence Bureau, which is equal to the MI5 or FBI in United States and UK, and also the CID, the Criminal Investigation Department, which is a localized organization. So every province at that point of time had an independent CID, which is not centralized. So their records, and also the case diaries of the police officers who investigated this assassination. So, and a lot of it is available here and there, but it all scattered. So the most tedious task of it was to dig out all these things from thousands, probably 10,000 of copies of Branton reports, and then piece it together and try and make sense of what really happened. So it is just like what you see in a movie. You know, you go to a conference room and start pinning like all this. So I was always fascinated by you know, thrillers. So so I always wanted to be in that character in The Mighty Heart, the movie, like, you know, where you pin all these sequence of events and trying to trace it. So it was like reliving a
you have a photo of that room.
Yeah, I do. It's right here. So we kind of piece it together and say, okay, so that is okay, so we got the start, we have the end, now it's about filling the gap, right? So now you start chasing the money and you start tracing the people. So where did they go? So we could trace the person who supplied the gun eventually, right? He had meeting with the lead figure of this political plot, and who was acquitted for lack of evidence thrice. So that's So we create. So all that we did, we not invented any new piece of information which was not available to the investigators at that point of time. So what we merely have done is collated a whole lot of information which was available then, put it in order to see a sequence of events. So it's all from the existing, from the records that is available with the security and the intelligence establishment, the police investigators, and the ideas. So we try to introduce along the investigation, what are the various political thoughts which figured and which led to. So it was a clash of two ideas. So there was a Gandhian idea of a state, a Gandhian idea of politics, a Gandhian idea of dealing with crisis. Vis-a-vis a right-wing idea of how do you do it. So we try to introduce various concepts. For instance, the militarization project, when did that start? And because that had a very, so the idea of a militant outfit and something very similar to we see, not just in South Asia, but across the world today, is vigilantism, right? So and a lot of understanding of vigilantism in India was informed by the fascist movement in Europe at that same time. So there was an interaction. So we tried to document as much as possible. So to try and build a capsule. So what happened in 1948 was a clash of previous 30 years of politics. It was a clash between a violent response with a non-violent response and an unraveling of that politics from 1948 to today. So this is one element in or one capsule in that history, which kind of captures the last 100 years of, or roughly 100 years of politics and how it is playing out and how it is coming back So I think it's important not just for the contemporary history of India, but also to inform the political debates across the globe at a time when we are seeing massive hate crimes or hate speech. So yeah, so that's the significance of both these things.
Thank you. That's very interesting. If I can just, you know, I know you mentioned it in the book, but for our audience who hasn't read your book, and for those who may not be familiar with India's political context, could you tell us why, as you mentioned, Apu, the police investigating at the time had access to all of this material? So why didn't they look into it? Why was, you know, it kind of not investigated to the full extent? And why was then another commission required in the 1960s? If you could just talk us through that.
Sure. So here's the thing. And this is probably my interactions with the police. So when I was an active reporter, as an investigative reporter, so I've interacted extensively with the security establishment, with the police and investigators. So I had understanding and insight into how they think. So I probably, so there are two people who could have told the story, the assassins, or the one who came close to the assassins through investigation, which is the cops. So I try to understand from their perspective. So the reality is that in 1948, when Gandhi's assassination just happened, there was a team was put in place to investigate this case. The fact is they didn't even have their own official vehicle, because the what we're looking at is a 1948 is a torn India. So we had one of the biggest partition violence. Millions of people were coming, flowing from one part of India to Pakistan and Pakistan to India, and Delhi was the center of it. And a young government was just came in place just 6 months ago. And the fact that they had no prior experience, or rather little experience with governance, and the police was still a colonial subject, right? So they, with the way they behaved is very different from, I mean, they still had a lot of freedom, and the police psyche is something that I'm familiar with. So you have an assassination, you got an assassin who's confessing to the fact that I killed, right? You got four more other characters to make a strong prosecution case closed. So that is from, for a young country like India, at that point of time, it was a shock. Like, you know, you have massive violence and then followed by your father of nation being assassinated. And then there are apprehensions today, well, who's next? Is it going to be the Prime Minister of India? Or is it going to be the Home Minister of India? Or is it going to be somebody else, right? So there's a whole chaos throughout. So they wanted to put the debate to bed, saying there has been assassination, an act by a very small person, a set of people, right? And extricate them from a larger politics and move on. So that is one of the motives, I think. That's one possibility. And there could be multiple other possibilities, but that's all would be guesswork. But I think just knowing the way the police behaves, or the police psyche of, or the investigative psyche, I think, you know, they had a watertight case to go to prosecution and secure a conviction. And that's a win. And that's what probably happened.
Okay. Changing gears slightly, and Apu, you mentioned the Bhutan movement and this focus on giving land by Vinoba Bhave, the land gift. And you also write about, or you also spoke about and write about, Gandhi's views on economic equality. And I wanted to talk a little bit about that. So reading from the book, and these are Gandhi's words, working for economic equality means abolishing the eternal conflict between capital and labor. Could you elaborate? Because I know you spend a bit of time in this book talking about that, and not so much about what Gandhi would have done, as you mentioned earlier, if he had lived, but unpacking those views, because obviously he was, you know, at a time when the Cold War was beginning to emerge. And he's saying, you know, I'm not on this side or this side. So can we talk about that a little bit, but to both of you, Priyanka and Apu, whoever wants to take and start that?
Yeah. So the Gandhi's idea of Swaraj or total independence is not hell-bent on the fact that we replace the colonial rulers with another set of political rulers or economic rulers. So so if you look at the high table, and I call it the high table because I try to understand politics and particularly politics of that time and even today from elite power politics, because it's about like a bunch of people who have taken governance and economic power who wanted to grab political power to further their interest or defend their interest or protect their interest, or I mean protect economic interest. So there were a couple of dominant players on the high table. One was a nationalist movement led by the Congress Party at that point of time, which also incidentally included a lot of elites. And then we had the princely state, and this I'm talking particularly of the Hindu princely states, because after some 800 years of being ruled by different set of outsiders, in their own language, for instance, the Mughals and later the British. So this is after 800 years, they had a strike. I mean, they were just one strike away from regaining power. And they had the support of the right-wing, the Hindu organizations who actually thought the princely states are the real custodian of India's culture, and thereby they should be significant players in the formation of any kind of government or political sharing post-independence. Right. So, and they naturally expected an invitation. But as early as 1944, that is when it was pretty clear that the British are about to leave, Gandhi has shifted gears in terms of, oh, I wouldn't say shifted gears, wrong word. Gandhi started putting focus on the princely state, and he was very critical of the princely states. So so that is that's an important event. So what does it mean? So Gandhi was developing economic thought. In fact, I urge everyone to look at the Gandhian economics at that point of time. So he has wrote a very small book, which is called The Constructive Program. It's about 30 pages. He's got about 30 recommendations. And if you actually take those 30 recommendations and read it along with Sen's capability theories, Amartya Sen's capability thesis, it's very similar. It's of course, was not as fleshed out as capability thesis, but all the element that you see there was right there, but in a language that a common man can understand. So Gandhian thing was, okay, so here is my framework and let me start working for it. So that's how we generally approach any subject, right? So, and what are the ways in which he, and he understood the human nature, right? So imagine what Gandhi achieved in 30 years. So he came to the scene in 1913. Since then to 1948, look at what all he has achieved. A country which is divided by different language, caste hierarchy, religion, and of course patriarchy, right? He is probably one leader who has brought maximum number of first generation women without any political background to politics. So number one. So he broke the patriarchal hierarchy there. He brought the people of the most backward community called who he calls as Harijans in the lowest in the pecking order of the caste hierarchy to politics, right? And many, right? So, and he did it all with navigating or negotiating between different power centers. So he understood the human nature very well, and particularly the elite. So his model of trusteeship is very interesting. So he kind of started propagating this theory of trusteeship, which essentially means, it's very similar to what the kind of trusteeship that we see today. It is like you make money and you are the custodian of wealth, but on behalf of people, right? So he was trying to bring in ethics and nonviolence into even business. So he was actually developing an alternative economic model, which is away from the capitalist idea of accumulation of wealth or the communist idea of redistribution of wealth, and trying to find a wire media in between to give a bit to both sides and but still get the maximum welfare. So I think that is, so the couple of things that we talked about, one, the constructive program as capability thesis as we understand, the sustainable economy, because at his economic model, a village republic was significant, which is you'd produce and develop things according to, I mean, every village has to be sustainable. So it meant, you eat the food that is local to your native to your place, right? And be a sustainable one and try and reduce in today's parlance, carbon footprint. So there were multiple economic thoughts, and one he was directly challenging was the economic concentration of wealth, right? So he was talking about redistribution of a different kind. I mean, you're saying, hey, you know, you're distributing wealth, but you know, you're the one. I mean, I want you to keep making money, but then you're just a custodian, right? And that was threatening the economic interest of the elite, and that is why in the book you will find reference that a lot of people who I mean, I'm talking about wealthy businessmen who was aware of what was going on. And another thing is the princely state. The princely state was also the custodian of both the culture as well as economic power to a large extent. And the princely bureaucracy who used to run the show driving power from the legitimacy of the state. So all this economic interest was being threatened by Gandhi.
I think, Armina, it's very interesting that you picked up the quote of Gandhi on capitalism and labor, because I think the fundamental opposition that Gandhi had to capitalism and communism was the inherent violence involved in it. Mm-hmm. Because the three principles that he followed were religious pluralism, truth, and nonviolence. These were the pillars on which he imagined a nation, or he imagined the character of the people who would comprise that nation. So I think that is what he wanted to address, the violence that would be inherent, whether it is capitalism or communism, where, you know, a revolution would have to be undertaken by the workers in order to overthrow the elite. And as Appu says, the elite formation is also something that he has repeatedly he began to attack in the 1940s, from the late 1930s onwards. And Constructive Program is a great little booklet to look at. And as we mentioned, Bhudan movement, which was how he thought of trusteeship as a model, is something that philanthropy today does do, but in a very limited way. But I know, I see Rose here, and I was introduced to participatory philanthropy by Rose in 2017 when we met. I think trusteeship model, the economic model that he was thinking about, was something along those lines. And in a very limited way, in a very different context, I think this is something that we've seen even in Islamic cultures of Baitul Mal, where although it comes from a point of view of charity, it is that everyone has enough to sustain. So the voluntary giving up, redistribution of wealth, because we see the collection of wealth as a public good and redistribution of wealth as a public good, is something that he thought about, and his thoughts were evolving around that. So I think that is something that we definitely missed out on because we took a slightly different path, India as a nation, initially socialism and then neoliberalism hit us. But that's something that I wanted to just add.
Very interesting. I have two questions that I'm going to open it to the floor. Since you mentioned Rose, who's there and in the audience, how did being in the AFSI Fellowship, in the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program, shape the writing or thinking of this book? I mean, did you know each other before you came to the LSE?
I'm so sorry. We were actually going to get married this February, but it's been put off due to the various strains.
Right. Okay. So this is a bit of background because I joined AFSI in 2020. So
we've been colleagues and we've been friends and partners.
Okay. Okay. Great.
Good that I didn't take that question. So the right answers came from her. So I said, I concur.
Great. Very interesting. Okay. And the last question before I turn to our audience, because I can see some questions coming up in the chat. You mentioned the current, you know, period and how the ideas of the Hindu Mahasabha and, you know, Savarkar's thinking has kind of been revived or, you know, is becoming very, very popularized today. So given this political context, how has your book been received in India? What are people saying? Is it, you know, are people saying, like, it? Could you talk us through the reception?
So it's I mean, I think, you know, the book has done pretty well. We've got some good feedback. Now, but if your question is in terms of, are we in jail? Not yet. Does it have any political implications? See, the thing is, and this is something, again, I really like all of us to think, because where Gandhi was successful was able to communicate his political ideas through a political act and in a simple language and a vocabulary that was easily consumed by the people. So on many, many contentious topics. So Gandhi himself was a very devout Hindu. He was a practicing devout Hindu. Now that didn't come in the way of practicing secularism. So whenever he was posed with a question, and particularly a very contentious question, which is like cow slaughter, because cow is considered as a holy animal in India. And even today you see riots happening because of cow slaughter or alleged cow slaughter. So whenever he was posed with this question, he never turned into a vocabulary of the West. And I'm talking about a classic definition of secularism that emerged in the West. He would rather turn to the Hindu script to explain, saying that secularism in a very different way, in a way that people understand. So, and I mean, various occasions, whenever there's a questions of cow slaughter comes, he'd say, my God has taught me to love the dog and the dog eater alike. Now, so that's kind of, and that's something that people can understand. So what he had done is he's also a religious reformer, right? So he used that vocabulary. Now, what is missing in India today is something like this, right? So unless or otherwise, we have a political leader. So what is really missing, not just for India, but globally, is a Gandhi, a unifier, right? Who had the moral standing, the trust of the public. And I'm talking about the low, everyone, I mean, from, you know, the 1% to the 99%. And until that happens, this is for history, this is for records, right? So a lot of people who have read the book, was historians and masters in this field, as learned a thing or two, which is something that we are very happy about. And I hope this will, add to the public debate. And in fact, just 3 days down the line is when Gandhi was assassinated in 1948, so January 30, 1948. So I'm sure, there are multiple perspectives, right? So you will see Godse trending, and I can bet you this will happen again this year, that Godse will be trending in Twitter on January 30, right? So there is an effort to rehabilitate the principal actors behind Gandhi's assassination. But whereas, like Priyanka pointed out right in the beginning, what we don't see, both sides, I'm talking about the people on the left spectrum or the right spectrum trying to rehabilitate or critically oppose the rehabilitation of the assassins behind Gandhi's murder, political assassination. But what we again missing out is rehabilitation of Gandhi in politics. So nobody really wanted to touch the Gandhi in politics, which is a very tough thing to do. Now, unless otherwise that is reinvented, this holds no significance, honestly speaking. I mean, I'll be very brutally honest. But for the sake of history, for the sake of the future generations who want to know what really happened that time, this will, I think, hold a place in the library.
if I could just say that, well, Nathuram Godse called Mahatma Gandhi an anti-national, according to, I mean, how we say it, that he was the first anti-national that, you know, was talked about. So if Gandhi is an anti-national, I don't know who fits the definition of who belongs to the nation and who doesn't. But I would say that our book has come at a time when there have been multiple efforts at hagiographies and scholarly work that has come from the right to talk about Savarkar's contribution to the Indian independence movement, to how he could have stopped partition. And it is difficult. I don't think there has been some sort of a counter narrative that has come to say that, you know, this sort of rehabilitation is dangerous, is a dangerous idea for the nation that we're becoming. So I think in that sense, we have made a contribution to a narrative that counters what is being popularized and what is being rehabilitated. And yes, it's not easy to do that. It has many ramifications that we won't entirely see right now, but I think this is just paving the way for, you know, others to come in and talk about truth and investigation and about this entire episode. There is a new book that's come out by a scholar, Dhirendra Jha, which again examines the role of Nathuram Godse. So I think we need a lot more efforts of this kind, because the numbers clearly are not with, you know, Gandhians, for lack of anything to say.
Yeah. No, thank you. Thank you so much. And again, well done on an incredible book, which I have just here. I don't think my purple screen doesn't allow you to see it. So I have some questions now, Apu and Priyanka, and I'm going to read those. And then if others want to ask a question, please put your hand up and I will call on you. But the first question in the chat comes from Ralph Schroeder. And Ralph writes, could you say how the Indian public before Modi and after interprets the motives and significance of the assassination? Has the interpretation of the motives, the religious motives in particular, changed over time? So the question is really about the Indian public's perceptions.
So, you know, if you actually look at it like that, there was a judge who heard the appeal of Gandhi's assassination. So two prime accused who were later sentenced to death, that is Godse and Apte, and he noted in his autobiography, that had the people who were present in the court were to pronounce a judgment, they would have let go of both Godse and Apte. So this is, I'm talking as early as 1948, which is immediately in the aftermath of Gandhi's assassination. Even at that point of time, there was a large section of people who sympathized with the assassins. And part of the reason was, you know, Gandhi was held responsible for a lot of things that was going on at that point of time. There was huge suffering, I mean, undoubtedly, because of the partition violence. Now, frankly speaking, I don't think that Gandhi has to be held responsible for that. It's a sequence of events, politics, power politics, and the colonial power politics too. But however, somehow Gandhi became the bad guy in this whole thing. So there was, at that point of time, I mean, I'm talking as early as 1948. Now, what you're seeing in the recent time is that information being most freely allowed to shape the public opinion, you've been seeing for the last 10 years, at least, the prime accused or the man who killed Gandhi has been trending in Twitter. And not just that, there have been events being held. And in fact, the context to the Kapoor Commission, which was a question that you asked at some point of time, is a consequence when another accused was released from jail after a life sentence, went out and said, there was a welcome party after, and that is Godse, the killer of Gandhi, his brother, when he was released from jail, there was an event in which there was a welcome event in which one of the top journalists of that point actually said, I knew about the assassination at least 2 weeks in advance. So there's nothing new. So before Gandhi too, I mean, before even Modi comes, there was, sympathizers for the assassins. And I wouldn't say that nothing, I mean, I would say it's a natural progression from there. And I wouldn't hold one person responsible for that, because if it happened in 1948, it's continued to now, it was not influenced by, maybe a change of political regime. No, I don't think so. But then, of course, there's a lot of, support for this kind of thought. And you will see in, what you see in the trolls today is a mini Godse. Mm. And I mean, there are millions of people out there in the internet space today who represents the thought process of somebody like Godse.
Okay.
Just to add to Apu's thing, I would just like to mention that we recorded this even in the book. There was an anonymous letter that Godse received after his trial, which was classified as an intelligence note by someone from Calcutta, who addressed him as, "You great pride of Hindus. You've done a great service to the nation by eliminating this man who is an appeaser of Muslims. And Nehru, watch out, you're next. We are hoping that you're next." And that's the same narrative that continues today, if you see. Mm. So it's quite interesting also that the religious persuasions have not really changed that much.
No, thank you for that. Before I take the next question, I'd like to welcome anyone who wants to turn on their camera. So we feel like you're there. I see all these black boxes, but don't feel pressured, if only if you want to. But it'd be lovely to see your faces in the space. So one of the questions, which I think, Apu, because you mentioned Twitter and you mentioned Godse, the hashtag kind of trending, I want to actually take Rose Longhurst's question, because this is an information issue, right? It's about communication issue. So Rose asks, what can we learn from the misinformation/disinformation in this context for the current environment?
So if you actually look at, and I've very closely studied, and this is something that Ralph will be very interested to know about history and misinformation. So one of the key things that, one of the key takeaways that I had from pursuing the statements by the assassin, Godse, a lot of his information was misinformed, right? And the earlier, so there was two attempts on Gandhi. The one which succeeded in quick succession. So one was in January 20th, 1948, and 10 days later, Gandhi was assassinated. So we've tried to understand the character called Madanlal Pava, who was a refugee, young guy, 20 years old, who just came from Pakistan, seen a whole lot of violence before making that attempt on 20th of January. So he was actually fed that for almost all his problems, Gandhi has to be held responsible, right? So there were talks about all kind of conspiracy theories, all imaginations, wild imaginations, it's all there. So misinformation becomes a central piece of othering. And what we are seeing today is othering happening at a massive scale. I would say what happened in Germany or what happened in India around that period of 1930s and 40s, I mean, just imagine if there was a social media or the free flow of information. It is not as if it was not there. It's not, we can't accuse the internet for doing this. It's just that it amplified or even, becomes a catalyst in this whole process. So misinformation, I think, is a single largest threat to humanity after climate change. And if you don't deal with it, I think the same 100-year cycle just happens. Like, we just had a global pandemic, which happened in 100 years, and we're probably looking at the similar circumstances we saw in the 1930s and 40s. It's not very far. So, So I would rate climate change and misinformation, misinformation and hate through internet is the single largest threat to humanity.
Yeah, thank you. There is a question from Gunit Malik, and you've touched upon this in your presentation, but Gunit asks, do you see any political implications in India of your work?
You know what so I firmly believed throughout my journalistic career and even today, journalistic activism is no response to political activism, right? So and it has to be, it's like the church and the state, it has to be different. So what, for any political change that has to happen in India, it has to be a political act. So what you're missing is a Gandhi. So instead of looking for a book, we should be looking for the next Gandhi, right? So when you have a next Gandhi, then this book is relevant. If you don't have a next Gandhi, it's gone. So I don't see, or I'm rather not under any kind of illusion that a journalistic piece of work is going to make much of a political dent. It is not, because like I said, journalistic activism is no response to political activism. And the moment we reconcile I think we have better chances at any kind of actual change on the ground, right? So, I mean, if you really wanted to make a political change in this country, so we actually have to go to these places, like what Gandhi did. I mean, so people who are not familiar with what Gandhi did, there's a place called Navakali, which is one of the most brutal theaters of partition violence, where, thousands were killed and raped and maimed. Gandhi spent months there, and what happened there was as an absolute miracle that people on both sides have given up on weapons. And there is a very interesting reference of that in by one of the key characters. So I would call a person by name B.S. Munjay, Dr. B.S. Munjay, who served in the Boers War in the King's Commission, who is the father of militarization of the Hindus. Right? So he is writing a letter in 1947 in January, many months before, and his and I think that letter summarizes what Gandhi is capable of, and that is exactly what everybody was worried about Gandhi. So the letter is something like this: that post Navakali, Gandhi went to Bihar, which is a nearby province, and he actually spoke to the Hindu rioters and made them give up their arms. So now B.S. Munjay, who's the father of Hindu militarization, goes to Bihar. And what he finds is that young Hindu rioters who have been jailed, and they feel bad of the fact that they have done something immoral. And that influence comes from Gandhi. So now he comes back and he writes a letter to the then Home Minister, Sardar Patel, also seen as an icon by many, particularly the right wing, because he's the strong Iron Man of India, as they call. I mean, he's actually called as Iron Man of India. He writes a letter saying that is revenge a bad thing, right? And this is where the question of Gandhi's approach, which is and why Gandhi was opposed by the right wing. I think a lot of it to do was with his nonviolence, because it's a question of masculinity. It's not just about how you win. It's not about winning, but it's also how you win, right? So, so that is the influence of Gandhi on public psyche. So, what we need today is a Gandhi, not more authors like us to kind of tell what to do.
Thank you, thank you. I think what you're talking about is the new ideas, and I think this is a really important point, because people say, if you don't like capitalism, and socialism has failed, what's the next idea? So I think this is something that you're hinting at as ideas, and coming from figures such as Gandhi. I have a few questions in the chat, but I'd like to invite a couple of other people to join this conversation. So George and Bonnie. So George, please unmute yourself and ask your question.
Thanks, Armine. I'm George Kunat. I work with Armine and Asma here and Emma. I can see three names from the AFC Atlantic Fellows core team. First of all, I want to congratulate Emma and Apu. I've been reading this book and I'm really enjoying it. Well done. And also, I think it's a very brave brave book, especially in the present political context. So after having said that, I do have a critical view, especially the socioeconomic programs of Gandhi that you mentioned in the book and you've been talking about here, although that is not my question. My criticism about that is I work in the state of Bihar and also in Jharkhand, where I had the opportunity to study deeply the impact of the idea of trusteeship, especially Bhutan movement, the gift of land, you know, land gift. Because many of the rich people who actually donated the land, when the Land Ceiling Act came into being, they wanted to get rid of the surplus land. And that surplus land was all land which was very unproductive. So thousands of acres land donated during this process of Bhutan was actually very unproductive land. I mean, I had the opportunity to travel around and study the thousands of acres that have been donated in this process. So therefore, the idea of trusteeship of the rich, in terms of its practicality, the policy itself or the program had lots of problems, criticism from that perspective, you know. But that's not my question. This is something that we can take up for discussion at another point, Gandhi's programs and policies. But my question is, in addition, what is the mechanism of rehabilitation of someone who in the few years ago we considered as an assassin or a murderer? Now that person gets rehabilitated as a hero. So what are the mechanisms? Is it just the change of political context that has led to this process of glorification? Or is it because a moment has come where Gandhi himself needs to be rehabilitated because of the fact the policies, programs, which I mentioned, people have come to realize that they have failed, and therefore Gandhi has taken a backseat in the Indian socioeconomic context. So what would be the mechanisms from your research, both of you? What are the mechanisms that rehabilitate a person, a murderer, an assassin, into someone sanctified? That's a question.
Okay. So, thanks for that critical note. In defense of Gandhi, everything he did was an experiment. And this is an experiment that he couldn't kind of complete. When we have the same skepticism when he started nonviolence, because nobody was able to believe that it can succeed. So it evolved, right? I mean, so Gandhi's, like I said, at the beginning, I said, Gandhi was in pursuit of truth, and truth is like infinity. So what was true yesterday? So it evolved, it continuously evolved. So Gandhi's own views, I mean, I hear a lot of criticism of Gandhi on, topics like racism. Of course, I mean, if you look at the early part of Gandhi, like, you know, there was a lot of racism in his own thought, and it's conditioning. So we'll also have to understand where he came from. But then he changed his stance. So there was no sense of ownership. Okay, I said something like this 10 years ago, then I'm going to stick to it. So Gandhi's thing was fast evolving, and trusteeship model was too early at that stage. I mean, and I think he didn't have enough time to kind of concentrate. But the idea is that he talked about sustainable economics or development economics when nobody was even looking at that, right? And trusteeship was a blend of a lot of things. So we were only pointing it towards the idea of how the Gandhian model of economic redistribution was threatening the elite interest. So that was the only point, and pushing, I mean, and connecting it back to the motive for funding an assassination project like that. And number two, about the rehabilitation. Now, there's a critical question. So a lot of things that Gandhi said or Gandhi pursued, only Gandhi believed in it. None of his disciples, one of the things that Godse said during his statement is that now since I've eliminated Gandhi, the national government can pursue national interest. And he specifically pointed out about an incident, which is called the Hyderabad police action, where a government under Nehru, who's considered as to be one of the most liberal politicians of that time. And in that action, roughly 50,000 Muslims were killed in a police action. Now, Godse was saying, had I not killed Gandhi, Nehru was never allowed to do this, or would have never been allowed to do this. So when it comes to the question of the use of, so Gandhi was a committed Ahimsavadi and a nonviolent messiah. So he abhorred any kind of violence, and he looked at state in a very different way. And if you look at the role, I mean, the state that conceived by, oh, the state that exists today, it's not very different from the state that the right wing also pursues, right? So when it comes to the question of nationalism or police or the legitimacy of using violence, right, there's hardly any difference. So now we are talking about rehabilitation of a person in this context. So our own conditioning or understanding of the legitimacy of use of violence by a state is very different. And also there's a question that we beg to ask ourselves. So now when it comes to a point of the use of violence by state, or when the state can intervene violently, right? The right and the center and the left is on one side, and Gandhi is on one side, right? So then the question is, a lot of definition that one holds as who's an anti-national, Gandhi fits a criteria of a common man's understanding. Now, then the question, then again, it begs and ask a question, who is an anti-national, right? And the fact that is this one political act? I mean, so Gandhi's assassination was a political act. I mean, let's first acknowledge it from there, right? So, okay, will a political act be held as an anti-national act, which is what's happening today? So now what we see here is the reverse of it. So, it also brings the criticism of the left, which we see very often these days. By the right, I mean, it's unfortunate, but it's called the cancel culture, right? So this one event undo everything that you've done in the past. So these are competing ideas. And what I think is needed is a dialogue which start from a point of view of trying to understand each other. And I always wonder, what if Godse had gone into a room to assassinate Gandhi? What would have happened that time was a conversation. I don't know what was the outcome. Maybe Godse would have still gone ahead and killed Gandhi, but there would have been a conversation of trying to understand each other. And that is the dialogue that is broken today. So today the center is moved either depending on the political spectrum, because both spectrums are moving so far from each other that what is natural. I mean, we are so happy that, for instance, Trump didn't put a nuclear bomb in Iran. I mean, we expected him to throw a missile and kill the high-ranking military officer. So, but we're okay. We're not surprised by the fact, okay, he did it, because the normal has become abnormal. So what we desperately need today is trying to bridge the gap, build the understanding between each other, try and understand where are they coming from, and strike a balance. And that's the only way to go forward. And that's exactly what Gandhi did for good 40 years in India's national movement. He tried to bring warring factions, made concessions to bring them together. Because I think where he was coming from, and I'm still trying to understand what he did in Navakali, because if we can understand what he did in Navakali to the fullest, I think we have a solution to a global peace. So I think where he was coming from is that if I can bring two warring people together to room and not, each other's throat, probably it improves their understanding about each other. And that way we'll find a solution. So even for Gandhi's assassin, I think we should not be hateful. It's perfectly fine if you get rehabilitated, but we have to kind of bring to forefront the warring ideas, not hate the messenger. They were representing two ideas, but we should try and understand where they're coming from and try to pursue each other come to terms with what is in the interest of, large interest in a non-violent way. I think we have to bring that whole question of non-violence back to everything that we are doing, including business, politics, or in public discourse.
Thanks, Apo. And thanks, George, for such an interesting question. We're down to the last 15 minutes. I have two questions. Bonnie, I'm going to ask you to ask yours. And then Vijay, Maitri, I will read your question that you have put in the chat. And if Priyanka and Apu, you could take those two questions together because we're nearly out of time of the official event. Bonnie, please, over to you. Good to see you.
Good to see you, everyone. I'm Bonnie, I'm from Botswana, and I just want to take this opportunity to thank Apu and Priyanka for that insightful conversation on what really happened with Gandhi. I personally love Gandhi. I think my question will then really be in terms of, I'm just curious about the civil society movement in India, you know, given the historic incidents that has transpired, particularly with Gandhi. So for people who are actually now doing the civil, the human rights movement, like, has it really changed? I'm looking at issues of security, issues of safety for human rights defenders in India. Has it really changed, especially those that are really following Gandhi's model? Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie, for that question. And I will also give you the question from Vijay, who had put it in the chat, who said, what are the idea of Sarvodaya? Youth can follow and still spread ripples of change in this tough time. Do you feel we have a strong need of modern Sabarmati Ashram in our country? Intellectual space. So Priyanka and Apu, those are the last two questions from the audience that we have time for. And please, over to you both.
Thanks.
Priyanka, you want to go on the first one? Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Bonnie. Just at the outset, I would say that most of our civil society movements and human rights defenders have pursued a path of nonviolence in how they dissent and how they protest. And the state character has become so strong that they are only quelled with violence. It is very difficult, I think, to be a human rights defender in India today, from being a right to information activist to someone coming onto the street like we saw last year at Shaheen Bagh, in Delhi, for women to come out and protest and assert their belonging to the country. It has become very difficult to pursue human rights in India peacefully or in any other way. I don't think there is, it has changed. It has changed because the state has given us no space for dissent anymore. The state is so occupying and everywhere that you have no space to raise any kind of question with what it's doing and how, where we can stand and ask questions and accountability from on any particular matter. Right now, I cannot dissent, I cannot say no. Freedom is just something that we celebrate every year. But I don't think we're living life as a majority of Indians are not living free lives. So that's on the human rights defenders thing. Thank you for asking that. Because in our opinion, our civil society movement is Gandhian at its core. It is moved by nonviolence.
I have a slightly different opinion from Priyanka here. So to begin with, I think we're trying to contextualize, this difficulty of dissent into a particular political regime. And I would like to say that it's not as much as true because it's also because over the last 74 years, when the reference that you're making here right now of a political regime was not in power, it was a fragile institutions that India built, right? So you're not getting if the different institutions in the country worked, say for instance the Supreme Court of India, and I think there's nothing has disappointed me as much as the Supreme Court of India. So it is not to be pinpointing it on a particular regime change. The state was always violent, and we had a similar episode in the 1970s. And a political regime, that the very character of the Indian state for the longest time has been very authoritarian. But of course, there was a certain amount of polishness, which you don't see to right now, and I would give that much. And again, we are living in a period where information is much more freely available. So you see a lot of incidents happening and it's coming up to forefront. It happened all the throughout, right? And the second thing is that coming about the Indian civil society, and I think Indian civil society has been a little elitist, unlike a Gandhian. So because Gandhi democratized the whole political participation. And I think one of the places where, because we keep talking about, I've heard it repeatedly in the last 5 to 7 years, that the Indian constitution is under threat, right? Now, if the Indian constitution is under threat for the last 75 years, so the majority of the people never had the opportunity to take the benefit of the Indian constitution. Now, why it is being shouted out from the rooftops is because a small set of people who had enjoyed the benefits of the constitution is now brought to power with the people who do not have the same benefit of the constitution, the bottom 80 or 90% of the population. So, and definitely there has been procedural violations and oversights and new precedents being set. But I don't see this as a new phenomenon. It's a continuing phenomenon. And I would think that this is a problem with the moral character of the people who've been holding this post for the last 74 years. And this is not something that came up in the last 5 or 7 years for which we are referring right now. So the Gandhian politics of morality is what was killed with Gandhi. Because Gandhi, the reason why that India had what Gandhi brought to politics was a sense of morality. And over a period of time, that is what got eroded. And that is the relevance of Gandhian politics.
Did you want to reflect on the second question as well?
Oh, yeah. So, sorry. Okay. My apologies. So the thing is, again, I would say that Gandhi was not just, I would always look at the Indian politics as before and after Gandhi, Gandhi's arrival. Like, so the Indian freedom movement before Gandhi's arrival was again an elite debating club. And I think it's very uncharitable from me to say that, but it's reflective of that. But Gandhi was someone who came, who had all these ideas, he pursued that ideas, got into the ground and made mass democratic participation into politics. So what we need than a space where, you know, we again sit like a Zoom call that we're doing, you know, sit and discuss what is the future of India or world, or how do we handle. He was a practitioner. He first demonstrated it through his own life, invoked confidence in the people, followers, and then implemented that with the military precisions, like, you know, a Dandi March, which is a satyagraha in India, where he walked several hundreds of kilometers to defy a colonial rule, to say, to have salt is my right. If you actually look at it, it was done with a military precision. In a sense, there was a set of people who went ahead of, like, a forward military party. Gandhi had his volunteers going ahead of him, moving to village by village, convincing people and getting them to organize, participate in this. So it's a lot of hard work. And what we need today is a central figure like that, right? Who have the moral authority, right? And have the conviction to pursue his ideas. If you look at it, the right-wing Hindu ideology consistently for the last 74 years since Gandhi's assassination has worked on their ideas. So whatever said and done, they have conviction and they follow through the conviction. Now that is missing on this side. And that's because we have abandoned Gandhi because it's very difficult to follow. And I think the only way that we rehabilitate or recapture that space is through practice. And what we need is a practitioner And those all the Gandhian idea is very simple. It's not like a very complicated ideas or something. It's very simple ideas. He used a vocabulary that people could relate to, right? And he, I think, most importantly, was one of the best was political communicator. And that is the reason why, even in such situations like Navakali, which I said, which is absolute bloodbath, like, you know, you've seen the worst of human beings in that few months of killing and raping and maiming, but he uses his communication and finally converted these people. So it's great to have these intellectual spaces, but that's not what the time demands. What the time demands is pursuing those ideas, and those are very difficult ones. And for that, we need to make it more democratic. So this elite gatekeeping is not going to help. And what Gandhi, I mean, probably what we have to do is take a chronological event of day one Gandhi arrived and what he did till this last day, and documenting what was his path, and probably we have some answers there.
Thank you.
Thank you, Vijay. I'll just use this opportunity to talk to what Vijay has said and also what George mentioned. I think I do agree with what Appu is saying, but more than we needing a Gandhi, I think what we found useful through the book was to examine masculinity, to examine a patriarchal, anxious masculinity that has become our national character, that has become the character of many, countries, many
global nations. Character.
Yeah, like a global character that has become is something that we need to understand and to sort of, eliminate. This is this anxious character has given us this national myth, which I'm just going to say that, the Hindus are in danger. It keeps on coming up, even though there is no fact to it, it cannot be substantiated with evidence, but it keeps on coming, for the last seven decades, this is what we've been hearing. And just to say that, how a murderer gets rehabilitated, it is these constructions of national myths based on misinformation, our army of trolls and these spaces that the antithesis of the Sabarmati ashrams perpetuating, this is where these myths are being constructed. And the framework that we thought of it was that Hindutva, or just for an example, Hindutva, or this anxious masculinity in of itself doesn't stand for anything. It stands because it is in opposition to something else. And that is what we really need to understand. We've also written in the book that the feeling was that Hindus are not militarized enough. We are not a unified body that we can defend ourselves from, advents from somewhere else. I don't understand how that idea still finds relevance, into today. So this is something that we wanted to approach, and Gandhi's ideas could be relevant in this sense of making a national character that is not built on an opposition of other or a lack in ourselves and thinking, imputing something that the others have, which is built on love, which is built on truth, which is built on nonviolence. And we quoted a poem, a Malayali poet, Madhusudanan Nair's poem, which Godse also says in his statement, that Gandhi is, his path is so difficult that his followers cannot follow. I think it's not practical to be so nonviolent in daily life. It's not practical. I can't not react. But I think that is the sacrifice. That is the character he's asking us to build. So that's my contribution.
Thank you both, Priyanka and Appu. It has been an absolute pleasure for me to chair today's event. Thank you, for presenting your thoughts and sharing your ideas, both in the book and at this discussion. And thank you also to everyone in the audience who joined us this evening.